there any questions? Well, I want to finish up talking about the Higgs today and then go on and talk a little about neutrino physics. And yesterday I presented some of the constraints. Within the standard model, there are theory constraints based on the running of the quartic coupling. And if the quartic coupling, of course, is related to the Higgs mass at low scale by mh equals root 2 lambda evaluated at the weak scale times nu itself. But at higher scales, the lambda for sufficiently large initial value, it increases because of the lambda self, the higher order terms in lambda in the renormalization group equations. Or for small lambda, it's actually top quark loops dominate and drive lambda to zero at a negative at large scales, which would destabilize the vacuum. And this would make things non-perturbative. So there is some sort of range that is possible theoretically between, perhaps 40 and 700 or 800 GeV if the new physics comes in at a very low scale. And that can be made fairly rigorous on other related grounds. And if there's no new physics up to the Planck scale, then there's only a fairly narrow range between about 100 and 180 that is allowed. Now, and of course, it's going to turn out that the experimental value is such that the experimental value is about here, so that the vacuum is destabilized at about 10 to the 11 GeV. However, it's metastable and lives longer than 14 billion years, so it's technically okay. There were direct searches for the Higgs, and the most stringent ones prior to the discovery were from the E plus E minus collider at CERN in Geneva, Switzerland, and above the Z pole, E plus E minus making a virtual Z goes to Z plus a Higgs. That's at a lower limit. There are indirect limits from the role of the Higgs in radiative corrections to precision electroweak physics, which narrowed it down to being less than about 150. And if one extends to supersymmetry, then there are theoretical constraints. Lambda is no longer a free parameter, it turns out, in supersymmetry. It's related to gauge couplings. And that puts theoretical upper limits of about 130 in the minimal supersymmetric version and 150 in extended versions. So all of this was sort of pointing to a light Higgs between 114 and 150. And if discovered in that range, it would be consistent with, but would certainly not prove supersymmetry. Okay, now to actually search for the Higgs, one has to talk about how does it decay. And, well, that depends on the mass. And if the mass is less than twice the W mass, the decay is dominantly into BB bar. Remember the couplings, I'm not going to write them all again, but the interaction strength for a fermion is proportional to M fermion over nu, and for a W or Z, it's proportional to M, say, W squared over nu, or if this is a z, it's mz squared over nu. And those are the basic vertices that are relevant to us in the existing Higgs searches. Okay, so if the Higgs is less than 2 mw, that means it cannot decay into a real W plus W minus pair. It's not kinematically allowed. And so this, it will decay predominantly into the lightest fermion that is possible, and that would be BB bar. I'm already assuming that we're not down at, you know, one GeV or something. That's long since been excluded. However, and the rate for this is easily calculable, or for any fermion, the rate is the number of colors. So this is 3 for a quark or 1 for a lepton times, turns out to be conveniently written as 4 root 2 pi beta f cubed mh. Beta is just the velocity of the fermion from the Higgs decay in the Higgs rest frame. The main point is that, however, that this is almost impossible to observe directly at the hadron collider, because there are so many QCD ways to make BB bar pairs that one is swamped by background. So I'll mention a way to get around that, but it's very, very difficult. So hard to observe. There are also, the next most important is into a pair of tau leptons. This also has big backgrounds, but they're not directly QCD, but you can make tau plus tau minus by photons or other means. So this is the next most important. So that would be for lighter than 2MW. I will just mention, although it's no longer so relevant, for HMH bigger than 2MW, then the dominant decay indeed is in the W plus W minus or in the ZZ. Let's say if it's greater than 2MZ, then because here you again you have this is related to a gauge coupling. MW is G times nu, so it's a gauge interaction strength, which is not huge, but it's not tiny like some of the fermion couplings. So this would be the dominant thing above about 150 or so. And if it were extremely heavy, twice the top quark mass, it would decay into TT bar. Okay, so the first new generation searches were done at the Tevatron. That's the antiproton-proton collider at Fermilab. And they were really only sensitive to this type of decay. And they just did not have enough energy or enough events to be able to be sensitive to other things. So basically, they were only sensitive in a narrow range of masses around 150 GeV, and they didn't see any events. And they got down to the level of sensitivity that would be expected for the maybe I should make, here's the mass of the Higgs. And so basically, this was excluded by LEP 2. This was suggested to be in this range by theory, but from precision experiments, but experimenters never pay any attention to what the theory says. So the Tevatron searched basically and excluded this region. And there were, and there are good theoretical reasons that it's, it could in principle have been much heavier. Okay, but then at the LHC at CERN, this is a PP machine, and they were had much more energy and they had much more luminosity, that is many, many more events. And they had sensitivity in the entire mass range from down here up to very, very high. And the focusing on the lower mass range, So let me come back to for mH less than 2mW, the dominant modes are BB bar, which is hard to see at a hadron collider, and tau plus tau minus, also hard to see, but those were the most dominant modes. But then the there's actually a decay into two gluons, and that's a loop induced. There's no direct Higgs gluon-gluon coupling, but there is a diagram in which you could have a Higgs T bar, and then the Higgs makes gluons. This is also impossible to see it directly at the Hadron machine, but I just listed. And then, however, a very important mode is H goes to WW star or ZZ star. So even if you cannot produce a W plus W minus, you can produce a virtual, let's say, ZZ star. So here's a Z. This is just a virtual Z, and then the virtual Z can decay, for example, into E minus, E plus, or anything else. And this, the one that's on shell also can decay into leptons or quarks. It can decay into quarks or other things, but the leptons are much cleaner to identify. So ultimately, this would go to 4 leptons. And it can decay into quarks, et cetera, also, but that's just the cleanest mode to identify. And this one could go into 2 leptons, 2 charged leptons plus 2 neutrinos. Finally, there are other loop-induced decays. H can go to 2 photons, or into a Z plus a photon. And these are also loop-induced, just like the 2 gluon decay. And the, for example, the 2 photon is dominated by, first of all, same diagram as for the gluons. And then there's a diagram in which this is a W gamma gamma. So for example, this could be W plus, W minus. And so these diagrams can lead to the 2 photon or replace a photon by a Z. And in the standard model, the branching ratio for this, for example, is for a 125 GeV Higgs is approximately 10 to the minus 2. So essentially, 99% of the time it would go to BB bar, much smaller amounts to these, about 1% of the time to this, but then a much smaller fraction will then actually go into 4 charged leptons. And the branching ratio for 2 gammas is about 2 times 10 to the minus 3. And there's a large cancellation, unfortunately, between these 2 diagrams in the standard model. And this one's a little bigger, but they largely cancel each other. Okay, so that's sort of the, for a low mass Higgs, these are the dominant branching ratios. And these are fairly rare decays, especially since you have to then put the branching ratios for the Z into leptons in here. But nevertheless, these two were the cleanest. And these were what was eventually first observed. But before I talk about that, let me say something about the production of the Higgs in a PP bar collider. There are a number of ways in which the Higgs can be produced in a hadron collider, and they're all have to be taken into account. Here I'm going to, I'm going to draw some Feynman diagrams. The basic idea, of course, is you've got the proton coming in with stuff going out, and then something happens. For example, you could have each proton could make, for example, a gluon. And then the two gluons could interact to produce a Higgs particle. And I'm going to draw this as just this. I'm only going to draw this part of the diagram. So that diagram I've already drawn up there in connection with the decay, but I'll just redraw it. And I'll draw it with the two gluons at the bottom. And then there's no direct coupling, but it goes via the top loop. In principle, all of the fermions contribute amplitudes here, but the top is by far the largest because it has the biggest mass and the largest Yukawa coupling. And this is called gluon fusion. Two gluons from the protons fuse to make a Higgs. And this is the most important diagram at current collider energies. Another one that is closely related is associated production of tops. So here's gluon, gluon, T, T, T bar, Higgs. So this is very similar. It's just that in the one case, the top and anti-top are actually produced. They don't close to form a virtual loop. This is much less important than this one, but it's called a top associated production. It's important enough that it has to be taken into account in the analyses, but it's still a detail. Okay, another one that's important is the what is called vector boson fusion. That's the diagram in which you have, this is Q, Q, and it can be Q, Q, or it could also be anti-quark, anti-quark. But quark is more important if you've got protons to start out. And this could be a W, W, Higgs. Or it could be a ZZ Higgs. And these are called vector boson fusion. And these are important as well. And these have the nice advantage that eventually these quarks will form jets. And so in principle, you can get some extra constraint by measuring the jets from the quarks. Finally, there's the diagram in which you have Q, Q bar. This could be a W, virtual W Higgs, or a virtual Z and a real Z. And this, if you just replace the quark with an electron and positron and just consider the Z, that's the diagram that the LEP2 was using. But here you could have its quark, anti-quark, and it could be either a W and C. And this is called associated. It's usually just called associated production. And this one is especially nice. It's not as important numerically, but here you've got a very nice signature. You can measure the Z or the W along with the Higgs. And so you have even a chance, if the Z decays cleanly into leptons, you could even maybe measure the H to BB bar mode here. So all of these are important. They're all taken into account in the analysis. And in at the LHC, they have the two big experiments, the detectors, ATLAS and CMS. And they intensely searched during 2011-2012 for these modes. And finally, they had preliminary evidence about 2 years ago. But in July of 2012, they announced at a major event at CERN, a major colloquium, a group announced the discovery via Higgs goes to 2 gamma, and Higgs goes to 4 charged leptons, which would be via ZZ star. And they both announced five standard deviation excesses of events is what's considered the signature for discovery in particle physics. And they had events with 2 photons, and there's all kinds of backgrounds, but there was a little bump in their distribution at 125 JeV, and there was a bump here as well. This was quite an event. This took place at in the morning at CERN, but that was simultaneous with the big International Physics Conference being held in Australia that year. So it was done at 8 a.m. in CERN and by telecast 8 p.m. or so in Australia. And unfortunately for people here in North America on the East Coast, it was at 2 a.m. But at most physics institutions, everybody came at 2 a.m. and watched the telecast. And in the United States, it was actually July 4th, which is a national holiday in the United States. But you know, the room, seminar room in Princeton was packed with people. So it was discovered. Its mass is about 125 JeV. And that basically completes the story. They've also excluded Higgs-like states at higher energies, although there's still room for some. But I mean, they've excluded the standard model Higgs at higher masses. But I mean, now they observed it. They quickly, of course, at first, all they had was, you know, excesses of events. One still has to establish that it's really the Higgs and not something else. And we still, one also always has to be careful about this. The most important thing was it was took a while, but we now are fairly confident that it has spin zero and even parity. It's a scalar, not a pseudoscalar. And this comes from angular distributions, especially of the leptons. So it's not a pseudoscalar. And it's not some sort of graviton. There's some theoretical reasons based on angular momentum that it couldn't be spin one if it decayed into 2 photons. This was very important because there are many competing theories that don't have an elementary Higgs, that have some sort of composite bound state played a role in the Higgs. And those usually predicted that there should be some light pseudoscalar state. they really had to usually stretch very hard to get it down to 125, but it's almost impossible in those, I shouldn't say almost impossible. Big classes of those theories are really excluded now, unless they look very, very, very much like the standard model elementary Higgs. So that's basically where we are. It's not a precision thing. So far, they've observed subsequently the W star, the tau plus tau minus, and the BB bar. But in the statistical significance of the tau plus tau minus and BB bar is still low, maybe 2.5 or 3 standard deviations. And the precision in which the couplings are measured is still rather crude, only 20 or 30% precision. And in fact, there's not perfect agreement between the two experiments. And early on, it seemed like this rate was factor of 2 larger than it should be in the standard model, but then more data later sort of brought it down better. But it's only a 20% measurement of the couplings. That will improve in the next higher energy runs at the LHC and either confirm or show evidence for deviation from the simplest picture. Okay, that's all I wanted to say about the Higgs. Are there any questions? Okay, the standard model is now basically complete. All of its ingredients are established. There are still a couple missing things in the standard model. It does not have any place for dark matter or for dark energy in the standard model, or at least not easy place. You could always say the dark energy is just that Higgs vacuum energy, but that's, you know, 50 orders, you'd have to fine tune that to 50 decimal places. You can certainly have new physics beyond the standard model to account for dark matter. And there are a lot of theoretical problems in the standard model that I'll allude to tomorrow. The theoretical problems are basically associated with the fact that it's so complicated and has so many parameters. You know, the gauge part is simple, relatively simple. It's well constrained, but there are all these Yukawa matrices with lots of free parameters, and we don't understand the patterns of the masses or the CKM mixings, et cetera, suggesting new physics. But there's one other aspect that I want to turn to now, and I'll spend some time on that tomorrow also, that is neutrinos. When Pauli first postulated the neutrino around 1930, it was thought it would be so ghostly, weakly interacting that it probably could never be directly confirmed. But in fact, the neutrino was observed in the 1950s by putting a detector close to a reactor and seeing the neutrinos or antineutrinos from the reactor rescatter. And subsequently, neutrinos have been studied intensely in weak decays and neutrino scattering experiments. And these experiments, I've said very little about them, but these experiments not only were critical for confirming the Fermi theory and then the weak neutral current and the SU2 cross U1 model, they're also very important in confirming QCD. Just like electron deep inelastic scattering from a proton, even though the electron is not a hadron, it was used to discover quarks, the neutrino can scatter nu n goes to either mu plus x or nu mu n goes by neutral current. This reaction established many of the properties of the SU2 cross U1 and confirmed the neutral current. And this one, since the weak charge current acting on the hadronic side can, for example, produce a charm quark off of a strange quark or a charm quark off of a down, this reaction was instrumental in probing the Flaber structure of the hadrons and in disentangling, for example, how much strange quark there is in the proton wave function. Anyway, it was implicitly assumed for a long time that there was no evidence for neutrino mass, and so people generally assumed that it was zero. And in fact, within the standard model, this could be easily enforced by simply saying that the left-handed neutrino is a doublet and the right-handed electron is a singlet, and that's it. You don't even need to introduce a right-handed partner for the neutrino. Remember, the new E left is related by CP conjugation to what we usually call the anti-neutrino right-handed. So this has to exist. This is basically the Hermitian conjugate. But you don't even have to introduce a right-handed neutrino. I have been introducing it, but always with some caveat that we don't really know whether it's there or not. Even to this day, we don't know. And this, if you do introduce it, it's a singlet under SU2, under U1. It has no gauge interactions. It's not really essential until we turn to the question of neutrino mass. It was realized by 1975 or so that there was indirect, let's say 1970, Ray Davis, who was a chemist by trade, put 100,000 gallons of cleaning fluid in a deep mine in South Dakota, a deep gold mine called the Homestake Mine. And this cleaning fluid was a neutrino detector, because neutrinos, electron neutrinos in the mine could turn a neutron into a proton and an E minus, or the actually some reaction on a nucleus. But the main point is these could actually be detect neutrinos. And the sun emits copious amounts numbers of electron neutrinos. The basic reaction chain in which ultimately four protons combine to make helium-4, generating the energy of the sun. There's various steps in that chain, and some of those steps involve the emission of an electron neutrino. So the idea in this solar neutrino experiment was to detect those and confirm the theory of the sun. Well, after the dust settled and a few years of refinements of the experiment and the astrophysical theory, it was realized that there were only about a third as many neutrinos. They were observed. Only about a third as many were observed as expected. And that could have been due to some property, as we'll see, of the neutrinos, basically that because of mixing of the new E with other flavors, they could change into other flavors that couldn't be detected directly. Or it could have been that the theories of the core of the sun were off a little bit. If you change the temperature of the core of the sun from by 5%, that would account for the factor of 3. And there was pretty good reason to believe the solar calculations, but it wasn't ironclad. So I'd say by 1975, that was the solar neutrino problem. And it took about 25 years to really understand what was going on, because one had to sort of disentangle the astrophysics and the neutrino physics simultaneously. And after 25 years or so, we finally understood that most of the effect is due to something funny in the neutrinos that can be attributed to neutrino mass. Then there were other experiments later involving atmospheric neutrinos, let's say 1990 on. And the idea is, here's the Earth, and you have high energy cosmic rays, let's say protons, which scatter off molecules or nuclei in the upper atmosphere and produce all kinds of junk. And amongst the junk are pions. I'll write pi plus, it could be pi minus also. And a pion will decay into a mu plus and a neutrino. And a mu plus decays into an E plus and a new mu and a new E, and mu plus new anti new mu new E. So if I don't distinguish between neutrino and antineutrino, you expect two new mu's for one new E. And by two new mu's, I mean a new mu and an anti new mu. Well, experiments, underground experiments, which were originally designed to actually search for proton decay, were sensitive to the neutrinos. So here's nu. They could scatter in the detector to produce an electron or a mu plus or a mu minus. And the 2-to-1 ratio was not observed. It was more like 1.4 to 1. So there seemed to be something funny going on with possibly the muon neutrinos. Later, that was the original thing. Later, they were able to do, by 1998, they had good angular distribution. That is, the neutrinos could come from this direction, or they could come from this direction, or they could come from any direction. And as we'll see, what's really happening is that the neutrinos, muon neutrinos can, we say, oscillate or change into other types of neutrinos. And if they're coming from the other side of the Earth, they have more time to do that. So basically, there should be a distinct angular distribution in the numbers of neutrinos if something's funny going on in the neutrinos. 1998, this was finally announced, the atmospheric neutrino oscillations. And I will describe what I mean by oscillations in more detail. And this, I would say that from 1980 on, there was a small segment of the particle physics community, and I was one of them, who thought very likely that neutrinos had mass. But from 1998 on, it was everybody agreed. Okay. So that's just the background. Now, before I get more into the theory of the neutrino mass, I want to say that the neutrinos have been very important as a test of astrophysics and cosmology. Neutrinos are a probe of the core of the sun, as I've already said. That's why the first experiments were done. Supernova dynamics . One class of supernovae are the core collapse ones, in which in the core of the sun, you burn hydrogen to make helium, and helium burns to make carbon, and then eventually you get to iron, and the gravity collapses the whole thing, and you have a supernova with an intense pulse of neutrinos coming out. And in fact, 99% of the energy in a type 2 supernova is in neutrinos, not in all the optical stuff. And in 1987, there was a supernova went off in the southern hemisphere in the Large Magellanic Cloud, a small galaxy, satellite galaxy to ours, and the neutrinos were measured. And that was especially a probe of neutrino mass and of the and confirmed the theoretical ideas about supernova dynamics. There's also the atmospheric neutrinos tell us something about the cosmic rays that produce them. Neutrinos are produced in violent things like active galactic nuclei. They're very relevant to the large scale structure of the universe. Because the amount of distribution of galaxies that can form depends on the different types of mass that are around, and neutrinos play a very significant role in this. They're important in nucleosynthesis, how you produce the nuclei in the Big Bang, in the sun, and in the supernovae, and they may be associated with baryon asymmetry. It's always very hard to use these because simultaneously one is has to disentangle the astrophysics and the neutrino properties, and that's still going on today. There's still a lot of cosmological studies that are simultaneously probes of the neutrino properties and of the cosmology. There's also geology. The geologist can measure how much heat emerges from the Earth, shows up in, you know, volcanic activity, etc. And there's two sources for that heat. Part of it is just the gravitational settling left over from the original formation of the Earth, and part of it is radioactive decays that produce neutrinos. And in recent years, some of the experiments have had the sensitivity to measure those neutrinos, and they're starting to give information about the structure of the Earth. Okay, so that's all background. What I want to do now is talk about neutrino mass, how you add neutrino mass to the standard model, and there's two basic mechanisms, and then that'll probably be just about all I can do today, and then I'll say a little about the experiments and the spectrum that we know, and I'll describe in more detail what a neutrino oscillation is. Okay, any questions first? Okay, let's first review what a fermion is in field theory. Oh, before I do that, I should say that we now know that the neutrinos do have mass. At least two of the three do. It's conceivable that one's still massless. The masses are less than an electron volt compared to, say, the electron mass, which is half a million electron volts. So they're very, very light compared to everything else. And the masses are so small that for normal weak decays and so forth, you can just pretend that they're massless. The effects are negligible, unless you have something that really is specifically sensitive to them. Okay, in field theory, the minimal fermion degree of freedom is the Weyl fermion, which is a two-component object. I'll call it psi left. And you can start with a four-component Dirac spinner and project out the left component if you like. But this can be treated on its own as a fundamental degree of freedom. You can also write a notation that just has two components to begin with. And this is automatically associated with a right-handed antifermion, as I've said several times. That's the two components, left-handed particle, right-handed antiparticle. You can't avoid that because they're just Hermitian adjoints of each other. So that's the minimal fermionic degree of freedom. And here I should say I'm talking about, you know, four space-time dimensions, et cetera. I'm not talking about, you know, five-dimensional theories or anything like that. Okay, now, and they're related by CP. It doesn't matter if the interactions are CP invariant or not. They're still related by the CP. Okay, that's my first definition. Now, let me turn to neutrinos in particular. I'm going to introduce what are called active neutrinos, which are also known as doublet or ordinary neutrinos. All of these terms are used. And these are just the things that we've been talking about for the last 2.5 weeks. These are the ones, SU2 doublet. Such as nu e minus left, nu mu left, mu minus left, nu tau, tau minus left. So these are ones that have a charge partner related under SU2 symmetry and have normal gauge, charge current gauge interactions. Sterile neutrino, also known as a singlet or right-handed, although right-handed's a misnomer. This is a neutrino that's in an SU2 singlet. So it has no SU2 cross U1 gauge interactions. We always have the charge is T3 plus Y, so if it's in a singlet, T3 is zero, charge is zero, so hypercharge is zero also. You could have a singlet with hypercharge, but then it would have electric charge, and we wouldn't call it a neutrino. Now up here, when I introduced vial fermion, I said it's left-handed, and then it has a right-handed antipartner. Which you call it a particle and which you call the antiparticle is just a convenience. And it was just convenient to call the left one the particle, right-handed, the other one the antiparticle. And it's usually in applications to our world, one calls such a singlet nu R. And it will have a CP conjugate that is nu CL. So right-handed sterile neutrino, CP conjugate, left-handed sterile antineutrino. No gauge interactions, no interactions at all, except possibly ones associated with the Yukawa couplings. So no SU2 cross U1 interactions. These are optional. You may or may not wish to add them to the standard model, and I have been adding them, but with caveats. New left goes to new C, right. Well, these were left out of the original formulation of the standard model. They weren't needed. But now that we know there's neutrino mass, they usually are added. Most extensions of the standard model have such things automatically. Not all extensions, but bigger groups and theories often have these automatically. So there's nothing surprising about a sterile neutrino. The only question is, how do these things couple to generate mass, et cetera? Okay, now. A fermion mass term . So when I say fermion mass, I'm talking about a term in a Lagrangian that will be associated with a mass for a fermion, is always some psi left goes to psi right transition. That is, one, we've typically written something like psi bar left psi right plus psi bar right, psi left. And it can be denoted pictorially as an X, just means mass. And so here's psi left going to psi right, or psi right goes to psi left. Remember, psi left is zero automatically because of the gamma phi projections. More generally, I could have said M here and M complex conjugate, but you can, and in fact, that complex conjugate is ultimately, when you have three families, is where the CP violation comes from. But I don't want to get into that now. I'll simply say that in simpler cases, you can always redefine the phases so that M is zero, is real. Okay. All fermion mass terms in a four-dimensional quantum field theory are of this form. However, I have not yet specified whether how these two vial spinners are related. And there are two possibilities. One is called a Dirac mass, or Dirac mass term. And this, and a Dirac mass term, psi L and psi R are distinct. That is, psi left is related to some psi C right, and psi right is related to some psi C left. These are independent vial spinners. They each have a CP conjugate. Altogether, there's four components. There is a conserved, at least in the mass term, L. L for lepton number. Namely, under, there's a U1 symmetry under which psi left goes to e to the I alpha psi left, psi right goes to e to the I alpha psi right, and then of course the psi c left goes to e to the minus I alpha psi c left, and similarly for psi c right, psi c right. So we say that the psi left, this mass term, leaves preserved a lepton number. You always take a psi into a psi, or a psi bar psi c into a psi c, and lepton number is conserved. And this is just the familiar mass term we've been talking about for 3 weeks. It's the same one that you probably only saw in field theory, or if Majorana was mentioned, it was probably only just mentioned. It's the conventional one. And specializing this to neutrinos, So we can specialize this to neutrinos, and we can have MD nu bar left, nu right, plus nu bar right, nu left. MD is just called the Dirac mass for the neutrino. It preserves lepton number. There are four components all together. And in the, one can define a Dirac field. I should have written it up there. This is the same as M psi bar psi, where psi is equal to psi left plus psi right. You can put these two vial spinners together to make a four-component Dirac field, and then the mass takes the simple form. This is sort of backwards from the way it's I did it before. Before, I introduced a Dirac field and then projected out left and right. Here, I'm starting with independent left and right and putting them together to make a Dirac. Okay, so I can do that for a neutrino, and we have a four component nu left plus nu right. We have four components, L conserved, delta T3 left is equal to plus or minus a half. That is, this is active with, and this with T3 of a half. This is sterile with T3 of zero, and et cetera. So we really have to generate this, we really need to have the Higgs come in. So it could be new right, new left. And so we're violating weak isospin by 1/2 unit. So you can't have a bare mass term. It has to be generated spontaneously by the Higgs mechanism, just like all the other fermion masses in the standard model. And this is perfectly fine. The only problem is that the MD is what I call H nu nu. And this is just the Yukawa coupling that sits here. And there's actually a root 2, and then there's a nu over root 2 here. And this is H nu times 246 GeV. And the whole thing is less than about 1 electron volt experimentally. So you have to have H nu less than about 10 to the minus 11. Yes? Nu is used twice in these equations. This is neutrino. This is the weak interaction scale. Yeah, yeah. It's just I always talked about this matrix gamma, which was mass matrix. I always wrote as some gamma times nu over root 2, and so I'm just calling the gamma would be H over root 2 is all. An eigenvalue, H is just one of the eigenvalues of gamma over root 2. The root 2s are such a nuisance. There's, I could make the statement in many contexts. I have tried, as have other people, to find the best notation, but the root 2s, et cetera, are such that if you make one equation look simple, another equation will always look awkward. Yes?
Just to clarify, I mean, in this situation, the right-handed neutrino is still a singlet.
It's a sterile, yeah. It's the one I was introducing in the SU2 cross U1 model. And you can generate a mass this way. The only problem is many people feel that it is on aesthetic or unsatisfactory or fine-tuned, they have a parameter that is less than 10 to the minus 11. Now, one should contrast this. The corresponding parameter for the top quark is a border 1, and the corresponding parameter for the electron is a border 10 to the minus 6. So the electron, Yukawa, is pretty small, too, but still 10 to the minus 11 is a lot smaller than 10 to the minus 6. So the simplest way to generate a Dirac mass is just by elementary Higgs mechanism by fine-tuning. Most detailed models actually impose some extra symmetry on the standard model. It might be a bigger gauge symmetry, it might be a global symmetry, it might be a discrete symmetry, but most models impose some extra symmetry that forces H nu to be zero, the first approximation, and then in some perturbation around zero, a very small value. So it is possible, or by fine-tuning. However, there's another possibility, and this will be the last thing today, Majorana mass. I can be more economical by using the right-handed field up there that I already have, namely the nu c right. This would be for the neutrino mt over 2, the 1/2 is sort of like the analog of a 1/2 for a Hermitian scalar. Instead of introducing an independent right-handed vial field, let's just make use of the CP conjugate of the one we already have. And this can be written as mt over 2 nu bar m nu m. Let me call this nu sub d for Dirac. Nu sub m is nu left plus nu c right. Majorana is the name of the physicist who invented this. You've also seen his name in connection with perhaps with the Majorana representation for gamma matrices. And he had an interesting story. He was in the 1930s, he got onto a ferry boat from Sicily to Italy and then didn't get off the boat. He disappeared and was never seen again. But anyway, this is more economical. Nu m goes under CP to itself. It's its own CP conjugate. And there are two components. Only nu left, nu c right. They're both active. L is violated. Units. L, you know, lepton number transformation here and here clearly is not a symmetry. It's violated. And in fact, pictorially, you have nu c right goes into nu left, antineutrino into neutrino. But you know, in a field theory, you can always sort of twist the lines around. You could have just as well, you could have out of nowhere, you could have two new lefts emerge just by, you know, incoming antineutrino also corresponds to an outgoing neutrino. So there's delta L equals 2. T equals triplet here, and that's because the delta I3, the delta T3 left is plus or minus 1. You go from minus 1/2 to plus 1/2. So you're violating weak isospin by a full unit. So SU2 cross U1 would not allow, you can erase, would not allow a bare mass term. And to generate this, there's basically two ways. One is introduce a Higgs triplet. Turns out it has to have a double charge, a single charge, and a zero to get everything right. And then you could generate this term by coupling with this phi zero if it had a VEB. Now you need to have H phi zero less than 1 electron volt. If this guy is comparable to the electroweak scale, you haven't gained anything. This still has to be small. But if somehow this VEB is very tiny, then this could be larger. In practice, models like this have not been very successful. There are all kinds of other constraints on such theories, but in principle, you could have it. The other possibility here is what we call a higher dimensional operator. Higher dimensional operator, that is to have engineer some interaction, nu c right, nu left, coupling to two Higgs, these are the ordinary Higgs doublets, nu, nu. This is a non-renormalizable interaction. A non-renormalizable interaction is always scaled by some mass parameter. And this would give an MD, M Majorana, around nu squared over M. If nu is 246 GeV, and whatever generates this, perhaps the exchange of some massive particle, mass M, if that's a border ten to the 14 GeV, then that would give a small mass. This is called a seesaw. The small neutrino mass is inversely proportional to some very large mass scale. And this mass scale may be generated by some underlying string theory or some underlying heavy particle. One particular manifestation of it I'll mention tomorrow is called the type 1 seesaw, in which it's just a heavy sterile neutrino. So those are the two possibilities. We do not know which is the one chosen by nature. And empirically, either a small direct mass term or a higher dimensional operator, and sometimes specifying the what goes on inside this blob to generate the operator. Okay, so I'll finish that story tomorrow and talk about a little about the experimental constraints, and then I'll sort of talk about general perspectives on where the standard model is going or not going.